There is a wave of wealth ready to change hands right now, and most people don't even know what's happening. Generation of baby boomers built their businesses over decades. Now they're ready to get out, finally retire, but they can't find buyers, which means there are businesses sitting out there right now with existing customers, existing income, existing systems, looking for the right person to take them over. Jeremy Pack has ringside seats to all of this. He's a chartered accountant and the managing director of Velocity Capital. He spends his days helping New Zealanders buy and sell businesses worth millions. And what he's learned about how wealth actually gets built in this country might change how you think about your own options.
A lot of people take the easy road in terms of salaried jobs, and I've done that myself for a long period of time. Owning a business, small or big, can be a really good opportunity for wealth creation.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. Obviously, it is easier to handle your money well if you have more of it. One way to do that is by increasing your income. And a serious cheat code to increasing your income can be running a business.
Some of the best businesses operate in really dirty industries. Waste and recycling, for example. One man's trash is another man's treasure.
All right then, who does this actually work for? How do you fund it? And what do you need to know before you start looking?
And maybe going to the vendor and who's the business owner and saying, I love to buy the business, but here's my finance capacity. Can you provide vendor finance?
So, welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And today, it's the secret wealth transfer that could be your ticket to earning more. This episode of Making Sense is supported by Odoo, the affordable way to get your business working smarter. Go to odoo.com, that's odoo.com for more. I want to help as many people as possible reach financial freedom by taking control of their money. You can help me in that mission. Two really easy ways. First, hit subscribe wherever you like to listen, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast player. Then send this episode to a friend so we can all level up together. Then the show grows and I can keep giving you the money info that makes a difference for your life. Okay, back to it.
Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you in because we've been going back and forth on this, and this topic is one that has been burning a hole in my brain for weeks. So I'm really pleased to have you in. You have a really interesting ringside seat to the business world. Before we dive into that though, as you've had these ringside seats, has there been anything that has surprised you about how people build wealth in New Zealand?
A lot of people take the easy road in terms of salaried jobs, and I've done that myself for a long period of time. I think owning a business, small or big, can be a really good opportunity for wealth creation. I think you reach a point where, and particularly in the last, say, 5 years, I've seen a lot of it where you are in a really high-powered corporate role potentially and earning good money, but then getting a bit disillusioned with the usual career. And that tends to be a tipping point, a bit of a catalyst for people to go, I think I might want to just own my own business and do my own thing. So I think business ownership is a really good way to create wealth.
I mean, yeah, what you've described there is kind of, I'm looking in a mirror and being like, you know, what's that Facebook option of when you want to untag yourself from a photo and you're like, I'm in this picture and I don't like it. That's a little bit what you just described there. And that's how I'm feeling after you said that, because I was definitely in a salaried role for a long time, knew I could earn more elsewhere. It took things going quite wrong with that salaried role for me to be like, oh, maybe I should just do my own thing and it could work out better. And it was a huge catalyst for wealth change, but it is hard stepping outside that, right? Do you think people, before they step into the business world, underestimate how much you can change your income level, your wealth building opportunity?
A lot of people naturally are quite fearful of what that means, because suddenly you're responsible for paying not just yourself, but your staff. If you're having to employ other people to generate an income, that's a really scary prospect for a lot of people. But I think going into a business and buying a business is very different from starting up your own business. If you look at the startup space, there's a lot of great ideas, but then getting product market fit, as they call it, and going through a couple of evolutions of that in some cases can be quite a long time frame between when you had come up with an idea and actually generating a profit, and enough of a profit to actually pay yourself a modest salary.
I've talked to a few people and they have different sort of ideas, but a lot of people say is if you're starting something from scratch, often you should wait anywhere from 2 to 5 years before you're expecting to turn profitable. What do you think of those sorts of timelines?
Honestly, quite realistic. I think some people are really, really lucky. A service is very different from a product, and a service-based business can be quite cash flow positive and quite lucrative. But again, in terms of the business model and the way that works, you reach capacity constraints. You need more people to generate income versus a product. And there's really good examples, like the guy that developed the shopping bag carrier.
Yes.
Fantastic example of, all right, I've got a great idea. I can see a problem. Get some funding, get some help, goes out, prototypes a couple of times. Fantastic success story. So you can do it. You can do it much faster than 2 years. It does require a lot of determination, grit, and just resilience. You just got to double down and believe in yourself. A lot of people have those self-limiting beliefs around what they're capable of doing. I think in the context of like a 40-year working life in the traditional sense, just quitting a job and giving it a go for 6 to 12 months, you'll know if you're a business owner or not.
Well, I think as well, from the experience that you've had and the area of the business world that you play in, it probably you end up in the place that you think has the most potential, right? So you help people buy existing businesses, or at least we were talking about it off camera before, and I described you as a little bit of a matchmaker. Yeah. So run me through what you actually do, and then we'll talk about the sort of the potential in there.
The business broker world tends to involve, here's a business owner that wants to sell their business, and they'll put some advertisements together and put on a website and to the newspaper and email a database. And I characterize that as like B2C, business to consumer. What I do that's completely different and counter to that is we have a very tight closed process. It's always confidential, and we identify domestically and importantly internationally who the potential buyers are in terms of the buyer universe. What I'll do is I'll help a business owner to usually 3-4 years in advance prepare a business for sale. Generally that can be a full-blown vendor due diligence exercise, so effectively coming in and auditing your own business. All your legal records, contracts with customers, suppliers, staff, looking at your business model, where are the growth opportunities, how do you realize that? Sometimes that involves introducing outside subject matter experts, supply chain management consultancies, digitization, e-commerce experts to help you whatever the growth paths are or the growth pillars are. And then when you are ready to sell, basically the whole negotiation process right through to the successful sale of the business. Most people really underestimate the amount of time that's involved in that. And it's generally a 6 to 12 month process. In most cases now, it tends to be about a 12-month process, which I think a lot of people fail to realize.
Well, what really catches me on this, because I've had so many conversations with people in passing, so this is why I was excited to get you to sit on the couch and actually have a conversation on the record, because there is this wave, I have been told, of boomers who have had businesses, often quite successful, and are looking to retire. And part of that retirement plan is to sell the business, not just exit it, but sell it, have someone else take over and keep running what is still a successful business. They're just tired and want to kick back. And yet, often quite struggling to find buyers or people who want to take it over. So does that match what you're seeing?
Absolutely. So I think, and I use this term affectionately, the boomers, and I think other people do as well. When you look at the demographics, you've got mid-50s. They're generally too young to retire. Most of their friends haven't retired. There's only so much traveling and sporting and other extracurricular pursuits you can do with your spouse. So who are you going to spend your time with and what do you want to do? And a lot of my friends who've had parents that have retired early in their 50s realize that their parents have retired too early, and they subsequently go back and buy another business or start up their next venture.
Classic.
Because they realize that I've still got more to give. Then you've got your mid-60s, which tends to be good health, good wealth, generally got grandchildren as well. They want to spend some time and do some travel. And that's really the critical period where they make a decision to sell. And then what I see happen in the 70s and 80s is people tend to hold on to the business a bit more than they ordinarily would. They do that, I think, primarily as you get older, naturally, people start to die. It's an unfortunate consequence of living, right? So they hold on to the business because that social network is incredibly important to them. It's the customers, the suppliers, the staff that takes up off the people that aren't in your life anymore. So they hold on to it and sometimes hold on too long. Sometimes the business can deteriorate over time because they're not continuing to invest in the business and grow the business. And it talks to that point that you raised before about productivity. So it's a cash cow. You milk the cash cow. Why reinvest back into the business? I'll leave that for someone else. But what happens around that age and stage is the business can really steadily deteriorate if you're not careful and if you're not continuing to invest. And then it becomes a business that's not particularly attractive, and you actually need to really get in there and change things up to make it more attractive to potential buyers.
Interesting. Because one of the things that makes me think when I'm thinking about this trend is there has been a lot of very good discussion about the intergenerational wealth disparities and how young people find it hard to get ahead. And this, to me, strikes me as potentially a lever that is able to be pulled, or an area that you can point people at and say, there's an opportunity here that maybe people are missing, that you can step up in a way. What do you think? Do you think there's a possibility here for people to step into income-generating opportunities, wealth-generating opportunities that's maybe being missed because we often think of starting businesses instead of buying them?
There's loads of people that would like to, very aspirationally, buy a business that's fully managed, delivering $1 million profit a year. There's no risk. And whenever I've got a business like that that meets those high level criteria, there's 100+ people clamoring.
I was
going to
say,
right?
Sign me up.
Right. Sign me up. Sounds great. And a lot of people go, why is the business owner selling? Well, if they're on the golf course and they get a mobile call and on their backswing at the 17th hole, we don't have enough money for payroll, right? You're still responsible for the business. I think that phased buy-in approach or staged transaction where you can buy a percentage of the business and work in it is a really good approach. Not appropriate for every business and every individual, but it can work. People need to have those conversations early and start working with your existing staff. Is always a great pool of people to have those conversations with. Some people go through 2 or 3 generations of a management team buying in. I think we're starting to see some second and third generation management teams buying in now. One of the big things is I capture this in my CRM to say, look, when are people planning on selling and why? And I can see on a fiscal year basis when the wave starts to come. I think next year we're going to see about a 3-fold increase. I was expecting it to happen this year, but the Iran conflict has kind of nailed a few things down. An election year always creates uncertainty, but next year, about a 3-fold increase in transaction volumes and businesses being sold. I think what that will mean is if you genuinely want to be selling your business and there's a finite pool of potential buyers domestically that want to buy it, and they may not have enough finance to buy all of it with their own sources of capital, wealth, and equity, they're going to need to rely on you as the business owner financing it or finding other sources of wealth from family, friends, whatnot, business syndicates to facilitate the transaction. So I think business owners are going to have a quite confronting wake-up call in 2-3 years' time when they're all trying to sell their businesses. And, well, you can't all sell to each other now as direct competitors in an industry environment, particularly because of Commerce Commission considerations. So you're going to need to open it up to financial buyers, people with money that want to buy it and may not necessarily have the means.
I want to pick up on something you mentioned there in terms of looking amongst your staff for potential buyers. That's a really interesting one that I hadn't thought of. So if we even flip that for a moment, because so many businesses in New Zealand are small to medium businesses, if someone is working in a business and thinking, I feel like I could run this one day, the owner is getting a bit older. Not to make assumptions about your boss, be careful how you have these conversations. But do you think that's a conversation worth having of saying, hey, you know, I'd like to step up within this business.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, if you're in a salaried role, are kind of afraid to have that conversation, but I think you do need to do it justice and actually have the initiative to hand raise and say, yes, I do want this. And if you show that initiative, I think you'll be surprised at the reciprocity. Business owners generally feel the burden of running a business. And if that load can be shared and you can buy into the business as a minority shareholder, 10, 15, 20, 30%, and step that up over time, that's a really good option for a lot of businesses and a great opportunity for people to step into a good business that they know intimately rather than, I've had a guts full, I'm going to set up shop somewhere else and do my own thing.
You're starting from scratch.
Starting from scratch. So buying a business is a really good way of creating wealth.
You mentioned there the finances, which I think is a really good point, because I think a lot of people will be listening to this and saying, you know, yeah, of course I'd love to do that, but you know, where do I find the funds? Which, fair. When people are thinking if they would like to step into this sort of business role and, you know, maybe skip a couple of steps by buying into an existing successful business, where do you get the cash? How do you make that work?
Well, look, a lot of people don't have the luxury of family and friends with money, right? Generally, the way that the banks would approach it, if you own your own property as an owner-occupier and you're consistently meeting your mortgage payments and paying down your mortgage over time, it used to be, say your property in Auckland was worth $1 million and you had a $500,000 mortgage, the bank would let you step back up to 80% of the value. So you'd be able to draw on $300,000 of capital to buy a business. And then it's, how do we make that roll up to something bigger in terms of the purchase price? So maybe going to the vendor and who's the business owner and saying, I'd love to buy the business, but here's my finance capacity. Can you provide vendor finance, which is a way of bridging that valuation gap? So the vendor loans you the money effectively, subordinate to the bank. So the bank has priority over all the assets and everything else. And the vendor has vendor finance. The buyer, as the individual, is going to pay back the business owner, but it's going to be over time. And it can be 1 year, it can be 5 years, and it's generally at a higher interest rate.
Yeah, how do you work out the numbers on that? Because obviously a lot of times if you're interested in a business, they'll open up the books to you. You can have a little look at, you know, profit and loss, all that good stuff. And you would hopefully work out sort of some sort of percentage return, right? So are you comparing that against, if you're getting into this, it's almost certainly going to require some sort of finance, right? So is that what you're comparing, those sorts of numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a lot of business owners, and this is why, particularly over the last couple of years when the market has turned and it's been tougher economic conditions, people are really sweating it out there. They're doing it really hard. And they're having to let staff go and make restructures to make the finances work because they've taken on debt to invest in plant and equipment, to hire new staff when they thought the market was turning at the start of this year. There's green shoots and now not so much at the moment. You've got to make some hard decisions as a business owner. I think making it stack up financially in terms of what you have available to you to buy the business versus what it's worth, that is really dealt with by a business finance broker, so someone who can actually specialize in providing business finance for these kind of transactions, who can help you to really syndicate the opportunity. They'll put it out to some tier one banks, BNZ, ASB, et cetera, potentially some tier two lenders to say, look, what does a finance package for this look like based on this deal structure? And then they'll come back and say, right, here are the proposed terms.
This episode of Making Sense is supported by Odoo because they're all about making business smarter, easier to manage, and more affordable. Odoo is a software platform that gives you access to over 70 apps to help you manage your website, accounting, invoicing, sales, inventory, and way more. But instead of death by a thousand cuts, where you pay for all of those apps individually, it's just one affordable subscription, which starts from $34.40 Aussie dollars per user per month. It's not just about the cost either. It's having all of those apps in one integrated dashboard to make your business or side hustle possible. Let your software work for you so you can handle the important stuff. Try Odoo for free for 15 days, no card details required. That's odoo.com for more. quick interruption to say, if you're enjoying this episode, you'll love The Market Memo, my weekly newsletter where I teach you how to actually invest. No jargon, no spreadsheets, just real talk about shares and how to make your money work for you. It's the thing I wish I'd had when I was starting out. You can sign up for free at francescook.co.nz/invest. That's francescook.co.nz/invest. But don't worry, I'll put the link in the show notes and the description of this podcast. All right, back to it.
When times get tough, like they certainly are right now, people might be listening to this and thinking, well, it sounds pretty hard to be a business owner, actually. What do you see that makes the difference between the businesses and the business owners that do well at times like this and the ones that maybe don't?
The business owners that stick their head in the sand, don't engage with the bank, don't engage with outside lenders and suppliers and everything else. Unfortunately, a lot of times they do go into liquidation or receivership. The ones that are more aggressive will start really doubling down and saying, look, I'll make some difficult decisions. I'll sell my own personal car and I'll double down and I'll lease the car because that frees up, look, $50,000 worth of cash. And that $50,000 worth of cash in terms of selling my vehicle and leasing it back is enough to get through this difficult period. So unfortunately, you do have to start stepping down staff, going through restructuring processes, which doesn't come easy because the people that are left, it's survivor bias and guilt. That's really hard. And as an organization, that's a really hard thing to work through. Really repositioning people and saying, look, can we step down from 40 hours a week down to 30? Do you want to take some agreed leave without pay? Do you want to do this? Back in 2008, when the global financial crisis hit, the big four firms and other professional services firms were saying, hey, look, we had 100 people starting on as summer interns or as year one associates. We'll just give you 10% and you can start next year. We'll give you 10% of your starting salary. We'll pay you for this year, but how about you start a year from now? And going back to some of those old playbooks is probably a really good decision. And actually, not being the only one that comes up with the ideas, if you want to, you can go to Business Mentors New Zealand and business coaches and a range of people in terms of trusted advisors. Your accountant and your lawyer are perfect for this kind of conversation. Look, if you ask for help, you'll get help. If you stick your head in the sand, you can end up in pretty dire straits.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that applies to so much of our money lives, that things can get tough for reasons totally out of your control at various points. And I think always just looking for what can I control right now and what can I actively do is always a better option than just like, I really hope this doesn't get worse and let's just sit tight. I've not seen that work out many times.
No.
Are there certain types of businesses that you think do really well here and are more of an opportunity? If someone is thinking, yeah, I would like to step into this realm, and it is, you know, not just that I'm interested in being a business owner, I'm interested in being a business owner because I want to grow my wealth. So are there certain types of businesses that tend to do really well here in New Zealand?
I've got a penchant for wholesale and import distribution businesses. It's a very simple business model where you're importing a product from someone else and matching it to customers in the country, right? Very predictable. You can jump on a Google Maps and mark out the area on Google Maps of a given business and go, right, that's an importer. Here's the square meters it operates from, and quite quickly deduce, here's the number of staff, here's the top line revenue, here's the profit. And then look at that and go, right, here's the customers it serves. Can we introduce more products to those same customers? Can we introduce those same products to different customers? And just think creatively around what is really a very simple business model to grow the business.
That is quite good. What about any that aren't good?
I don't think there's any businesses that aren't necessarily good. They're neither good nor bad. In fact, some of the best businesses operate in really dirty industries. Waste and recycling, for example. One man's trash is another man's treasure. There's a lot of listed businesses that do very well in the waste management sector.
Do you think there are any businesses that are overhyped? Because this might be my own bias showing, because people talk to me about this a lot. Because I'm obviously very much in the digital space. Not all of my business is digital, but it's very online. It's very social media and the internet. And so people talk to me about that a lot and will often say, you know, I'm really interested in trying X, Y, and Z. And I'm sort of the perspective, obviously I'm in this business because I think there's huge potential. And obviously, so far so good, right? I'm still here 2 years later. Great. But when I look at it and I sort of assess it as a business model, you can do so much digitally and online. You can build really fast. So can everyone else. You know, there's not much of a moat around your business, yeah. You know, so you can build really fast. You have a lot of amazing sort of softwares that can help you do great things and reach new people these days. But again, so can everyone else. And so when there's less competition and when there's less barriers to you, so there is to everyone else. And, you know, you mentioned the import business. That's maybe a little trickier to set up, but so it is for everyone else. And so you have to kind of weigh up these things of what do I think is a good opportunity? What am I uniquely skilled at? And also what might everyone else also be skilled at, right? So I think despite me being in this area that I think some of the online businesses can be overhyped, is there anywhere that strikes you similarly?
I think in terms of the venture capital space, what you look at when you're talking about online and e-commerce businesses, New Zealand's done exceptionally well, and in some cases, some bootstrap founders just absolutely going global with virtually no equity investors and outside funding. Huge success stories. Those kind of businesses can do really, really well. I think when you're competing on a global stage, there's always going to be people that copycat and emulate. A really good example would be when I was living in the UK for about 6 years, there was a mattress company, and effectively, here's a drop shipped mattress straight to your door that you can just unfurl in your apartment. And
what was with the mattresses? It was such a thing for a while.
It was Eve and Casper. And so I think it was Eve that started in the UK only as single market. And Casper basically did this, and within 6 months, complete copycat model and doubled down and went global. And that was the only reason why they came out ahead, because rather than focus on single market, they went global first and had deeper pockets, right? So you just drive your competitor out. So in some cases, that first mover advantage, you need to back it up with capital to be able to create a moat, because without data, without customers, without supplier relationships, without all those sources of intellectual property and intrinsic value, you don't really have that. So you need to accelerate faster. Venture capital is a really good way of doing that. But a lot of those businesses do fail. And I think when you're talking about digital and e-commerce, again, lower barriers to entry. You can, here's a website that I want to emulate, boof, 2 minutes later, here's a sparkling, gleaming one that looks on the face of it completely different, but same business, right? So that the barriers are a lot weaker. And then you're also at the mercy of social media giants. So came up on my LinkedIn feed yesterday or the day before, there was an accountant that had 25 different accounts on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. Not only did they cancel and permanently delete without any right of recourse all of her accounts, also her sister and her sister's business, because they were associated. It's like, what
did she do?
Nothing. Nothing. She's an accountant.
Oh, no.
I just went, oh, wow.
And I'm so been, invested
there's been,
now.
There's been loads of like really scary stories. No, it's gone, right? It's gone.
No.
So exactly, right? In one sense, you capture that premium because you're owning the customer relationship, but you're doing it on someone else's platform. So that's why you generally want to own that whole value chain around. If you're doing e-commerce, you want to have your own platform. You want to have that direct customer relationship. People think about, oh yeah, we're an e-commerce business. Do you have in your supplier agreements a non-compete and full ownership of the intellectual property? Because your Chinese supplier could go, hey, this business is going absolutely gangbusters, like 5-10 million of revenue in New Zealand. Wow. Don't worry about supplying this business anymore. We'll just go direct ourselves because we're making the product. All we're doing is creating a shop front now. And suddenly your business evaporates overnight. It's about making sure from a legal perspective, you've got the right protections there so that you can't really get undone. I don't think there's necessarily one business model that's better than the other. It's just about finding something that you're excited about, that you think's a great idea. And like I said, giving it a go.
Yeah.
You can start a business with very low barriers to entry, right? Register a business for $150 on the company's office, put up a website, do some ads. All right, there's people that actually want this product. All right, go and find the product, right? Put them on a wait list and we'll be back to you in 6 weeks. We'll go and find the product.
Yeah. Okay. So if you were talking to someone and they were saying, I'd really like to become a business owner and I'm weighing up whether I start a business or buy one, what sort of things would you walk them through to think about?
A lot of people aren't good business owners. And I'll say that, right, because I've seen it a lot. And the reality is, the harsh reality, a lot of businesses will fail before year two or year three, more than 50%. Sometimes it's not understanding your finances. Sometimes it's not understanding your product, not understanding your customer. So you go and buy a whole lot of stock because you think this is a great idea, but then you haven't figured out a way of getting that into the hands of customers. And, or worse again, the customers don't actually want it. You don't have any customers. Now you've just got a whole lot of stock that's unsaleable. So actually thinking through and running yourself through a process to make sure it's the right kind of business. So like a minimum viable product, testing out your theory, a lot of pointing and shooting before you buy the big cannon and go all in. I think getting the right support network around you. So people are really fearful of testing out their ideas with people and saying, hey, I've been thinking about this. What do you think? Fearful that, oh, someone else is going to set up in competition with you. Well, if they're a friend, why would they do that?
Yeah.
That's point one. Point
also,
two,
back yourself to do it better.
Absolutely, right? You've got to trust other people. A lot of like venture capital firms and so on, they won't sign NDAs, and the NDAs practically aren't worth the paper they're written on. You're coming to them with an idea. You're coming to them because you don't have money to realize this, and you don't quite know if it's the right idea yet either. So you really do need to sense check it with a lot of people before you really make a go of it.
I remember talking to someone once. They were saying that they could always tell when someone was a new entrepreneur, because when they were looking for investors and they were having these conversations, they would bring along something like an NDA. And,
you know, yes.
And they were saying, you know, the idea, while yes, is important and valuable, that's not the valuable bit. Anyone can have an idea. Most people have had an idea and said, ah, if I was going to get into business, I'd do this. But did you? Because that's the hard part.
Yeah.
You know?
You actually got to do.
To do it is the hard part.
Absolutely.
To sit down and go, okay, I'm now going to make that work by doing this. I'm going to start putting time into that. I'm going to invest my money into this. That having the idea is good and great and sure important, but executing on it is 80 to 90% of it. And so to bring along the NDA was a bit like, you don't know what the hard bit is yet. You know?
I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because a lot of, and particularly larger overseas venture capital firms, have entrepreneurs in residence, EIRs, who are, they've gone through one or two or three exits. They've started a business, scaled it up, grown it, exited, and done it two or three times over. Great, you're the right person. Now we just need to marry you with the right idea. The reality is, these venture capital firms, they have money to deploy and networks to assist. They do not want to be operating a business. That is what they're trying to avoid at all costs.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Flip side of that, if someone is interested in buying a business and they think, I want to step straight into it in the mid-flow, you know, that this has already got customers, there's a system in place, but I think I could scale it up and turn it into something even more. When you're thinking about that and looking for a good place to try that strategy, are there good ways to stress test businesses that you're interested in?
In most cases, you can, and this is something that kind of gets overlooked in the business broker part of the market. It certainly happens a lot at the like B2B M&A space. You have management presentations where you're dealing with the buyers, and it's a customized presentation to highlight the opportunity and also address some of the risks that the buyers are perceiving, et cetera, et cetera. But generally, at the business broker end of the market, you can sit down with a business owner and say, why haven't you done this? Or what do you think about this? And they'll give you some pretty quick education and schooling lessons about why that's a terrible idea, because if you're a wholesaler and you're doing e-commerce, you're shooting your own customers in the foot because you're cannibalizing their market, right? They own the consumer part of the market. You're selling to the customer. So there's like rookie mistakes that people make. And look, those confidential discussions are there and you've got the opportunity to ask those kind of questions and go, right, here's what I'm thinking. Would this or would this not work? And really like going there with a really curious mindset and asking the right questions. And in some cases, if you're lucky, you can do that two or three times over and definitely during the due diligence process to really not only satisfy yourself that the business is right, but after you take over, really start accelerating that next growth trajectory after you've bought it. The due diligence period, a lot of people go in very risk-focused, which is the right approach, but also you need to be thinking about the growth and how do we realize those growth opportunities. So that's an opportunity to stress test your assumptions, your hypothesis, and see, is that going to work?
I think one of the other things that's come up in this conversation is the stamina it takes, frankly, to run a business.
Yeah.
It is quite different from having a job.
It is very different.
Right? So if someone is thinking about this and thinking, I'd love it, I want to figure out if I'm cut out for it, beyond the numbers, how do you figure out if you've got the stamina for this?
We've all got 24 hours in a day. You and I are very similar in terms of age and stage and family situation. You've got a four-year-old and a two-year-old, and I've got a four-year-old and a three-year-old.
So we have no stamina, basically.
Well,
we're just
stamina.
Tired
yeah,
all the
we've
time.
We've got two coffees a day each yeah. and we're going for it. You've got to have the right risk appetite and you've got to get used to taking risks. A lot of business owners have a different risk appetite that can be learned.
I would say that I am someone who, a few episodes back, I was saying I'm an aggressive investor, but my guest called me a passive-aggressive investor, which I loved, and I'm going to use that now. I should really turn that into the tagline for the pod, because I can be very aggressive within certain boundaries of what I believe to be true. I am not someone who goes into crypto or anything like that, but I am someone who is fine with going hard on the share market, which would scare some people in terms of sometimes my percentage allocation. It started with investing, but I've taken that approach to a lot of life as I have scaled up some of these moves and tried things and figured out, oh, didn't die. Let's try it again, yeah. You know? And, you know, I run this business with my husband, right? He's very much more a cautious person than I am. We'll sometimes run into roadblocks in the business and he'll be like, I don't think we should do this. There's a real risk of it going wrong. And I've literally turned to him and said, I back my ability to earn more money and to cover that, and it'll be fine. And he's just like,
Yep.
Okay.
We all have those conversations. Yeah. Though.
He's like, I'm glad you're so confident. I am not. But it's a really good marriage in terms of he pulls me back from being overconfident, whereas I really have developed over time a much stronger risk appetite than I ever would have thought. And me 5 years ago would never be here in this business making some of the moves I am behind the scenes. And I think that is something over time that if someone is listening to this and thinking business sounds hard, risk and reward is always linked in the money world, right? And I think you start with taking a couple of riskier steps, testing that out, teaching yourself you didn't die, and you can learn those risk appetites within certain boundaries, right? You're never going totally crazy, but you're learning to take calculated risks. There we go. I spoke for a long time to get to the landing point. Calculated risks. I think that's the point, right?
Yep, completely agree. I think a really safe way of doing that in the confines of employment is hand raising and saying, hey, look, to your one up or your CEO or the owner of the business, hey, what are you struggling with? What kind of challenges are you having? How can I help? Yeah. Right? And all right, what do we need to do to grow the business, to fix this issue? And taking some ownership of a problem and coming up with a solution will help you step outside of your comfort zone. It's just about flexing the muscle, and the more time you flex it, adaption. So you do need to take risks to the point that you're comfortable giving it a go, stepping out, doing your own thing, or buying a business and really backing yourself.
Yeah. All right. What is something that you wish more people understood about the business world?
Number one, it's lonely at the top. Number two, there's a lot more help than you realize. There's a lot of forums and networks that you can tap into that people just are afraid of. Business coaches can operate across a range of different industries, industry agnostic as I am, and provide some really meaningful value. Business owners tend to be quite apprehensive about introducing cost into the business and conflate cost with value. And I've seen many business owners meaningfully engage with outside consultants or business coaches, and the payback's pretty quick. Sometimes 3 months, sometimes it's 9 to 12 months. And then you start seeing some pretty powerful change in the business. Businesses reach a scale where it reaches a happy place where the business owner doesn't want to take it on that next leg of journey. And they get to the point that they just want to milk the cash cow. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. In the context of getting ready to sell the business and planning for their exit journey, you do need to have the right group of people around you to help you on the journey, because it is lonely at the top.
It's interesting. When I was listening to a podcaster who I really enjoy, I'm deep down the Prof G rabbit hole, if anyone else listens to him.
Prof G?
Oh, he's great. and I think his actual name is Scott Galloway, but he's really good on the branding. He's just Prof G in my mind. American investor and business owner. And he was talking about how he really prides himself in hiring the right people, because he is prolific. He is everywhere. And people will say things to him like, oh, I love those cartoons you produce. And he's like, I don't produce cartoons. I can't draw anything to save my life. I have people who work for me who take the things that I say elsewhere and turn it into a good cartoon for people to enjoy that stuff. And I've hired really well, you know, and he's built a huge business based on that. And that really stuck with me as well, because it is terrifying to sign up to new costs, but it can open up new things. And I think your point about the mentorship and the coaching as well, there are ways you can start that for less money, but investing in your own knowledge and your own networks, huge, right? I mean, business is based on people.
Yeah. The New Zealand network is actually relatively small in the scheme of things, right? We all know each other in some way, shape or form, one degree of separation. But the fantastic news about that is everyone is happy to help.
Very.
Very, very happy to help and engage and see what they can do to whatever the situation is. It may not be, I can help you. It's, I know someone, or I think I know someone who might know someone. And it's often that 2 or even 6 degree of separation that can just deliver some absolutely out of the world outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me know your thoughts on this, because I think when I talk to people who aren't running a business, that one of the misconceptions is that the business world must be very backbitey. And I found very much the opposite. There are exceptions. But I've found that most people love being involved in success. So if they see you doing well and they think they can help in some way, they actually love jumping in and being like, hey, can I introduce you to someone? They find it quite exciting. Has that been something you've found too?
Yeah, completely agree with what you're describing. I mean, there is in some cases really intense rivalry in some industries, and in others, frenemies, right? We
yeah.
are personal friends despite working as directly competing businesses.
Yeah.
And we socialize outside of business as well, which is bizarre. And red flag, perhaps cartel behavior or something like that. But there's lots of people in business, and you need to keep a really open mind around who can help you.
And I think even if people are worried about competitors, which depending on the industry may or may not be an issue, you can often find people with a similar business structure in a different industry.
Absolutely.
And that's been an amazing one for me. Like, I will sometimes talk to other podcasters, but they're in a totally different subject area. So we are not competitors. We do not have the same audience, but we have so much information that we can use to help each other, you know?
Exactly.
Or other people in the personal finance space who aren't in the media space. Again, we're not competitors. So that really takes the pressure off there. I've found that quite a useful tactic. Look, if there was one thing that people were listening to this conversation and there was one thing that people took from it, what do you hope that would be?
I think Kiwis need to believe in themselves. Fundamentally, you need to believe in yourself. If you change your mindset will get you, mindset and attitude will get you 50, 60% of the way there. If you can get over the mental limiting self-beliefs, the hurdles, realize that there are people out there who will help you, you can do some pretty powerful things.
I so agree. Thank you so much. What a great note to leave it on. Jeremy Pack, come back in any day. Now, if this episode was helpful to you, send it to a friend. We can all level up with our money together. Until next time, have a great day.
This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most situations. It's not individual financial advice. If you're after that, a financial advisor is always the best bet.